You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 5th of November 2014 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One. I'm Emma Nelson on today's show.
I'm telling you that if you don't fight terror, the whole world doesn't fight terror. Similarly to what we fight, it's going to haunt you, not me, not us in Jerusalem. So the problem is a global problem, and I'm demanding the global world to unite together against terror.
We have a Middle East special today. Shashank Joshi and Daniela Peled unpick the news from Israel, Lebanon and Egypt. Then we get the latest from Our Lady in Brussels and we celebrate four decades of Blondie. All that plus Matt Wolfe from the International New York Times fills us in on the best theatre on offer. That's all to come here on Midori House with me, Emma Nelson. So lots coming up in the next hour here on Midori House, but before that, let's get the latest world news now. Here's Bill Bingham.
Monocle 24 News. A Republican tide has swept the US Senate away from Democrats, giving the Conservative Party full control of Congress. Their success will limit President Barack Obama's lawmaking agenda during his last 2 years in office. The decisive win shifts the balance of power between the White House and Capitol Hill only 6 years after Mr. Obama's Democrats swept to power. During that time, the Democrats marginalized the Republicans in a rush to reform health care, Wall Street, and pass a huge fiscal stimulus package. Now it's the Democrats who'll take the back seat on Capitol Hill, relying mostly on the power of the filibuster to obstruct Republicans and keep Mr. Obama's legacy intact. These voters in Virginia and Maryland say change was inevitable.
There are too many takers and givers. I mean, we've reached that midpoint, and I just think it needs to change.
Obamacare, they are still fighting it till tomorrow, regardless of the fact that more than 10 million people have signed up and are benefiting from it. It's going to be repealed. Am I wrong?
We've lost a lot of compassion, so I think we need to start looking at that some more, because until we lift everybody up, all of us lose.
With our system, it's good to have the checks and balances. I think the American people, they don't want to put all our eggs in one basket, and this is proof of that.
An Israeli border police officer has been killed in eastern Jerusalem when the driver of a commercial van ran him over. Israeli police say 13 pedestrians were also injured by the vehicle before the driver got out and attacked several people with a metal bar. Police shot and killed the attacker, who was identified as a member of the Islamist Hamas movement and a resident of the Shu'afat Palestinian refugee camp in eastern Jerusalem. The attack came on another day of tension between Israelis and Palestinians over Jerusalem's Temple Mount, one of the holiest sites in Judaism and Islam. No motive for the van attack has been revealed, but Hamas has backed it, saying Jerusalem is pushing them to prepare for war. Israeli police spokesman Mickey Rosenfeld says they responded to a disturbance at Jerusalem's light railway.
The suspect drove his vehicle into four people, 500 metres from where we are at the moment, continued down the main road and arrived at the junction just behind me, where a further 10 people were injured. At the moment, the hospitals in Jerusalem have been opened. The terrorist tried to flee the vehicle. He had a metal bar in his hand and he was shot and killed by border police who arrived at the scene.
At least 11 children are thought to have been killed in Damascus when mortars fell on a school in an eastern district of the Syrian capital. The British-based Syrian Observatory for Human Rights says the death toll is expected to rise. Two teenagers have been killed by shelling while playing football on a school field in the rebel-held city of Donetsk in Ukraine. Witnesses say at least four more people were wounded. The incident happened about 3 kilometres from Donetsk airport, where separatists have been fighting to seize control from government forces. Clashes have continued despite a ceasefire declared on the 5th of September. The presidents of Nigeria, Ghana and Senegal have arrived in Burkina Faso to push the army to speed up the transition of power to civilian leaders. The African Union accused the military of acting unconstitutionally when it took over from President Blaise Compaoré last week. He was forced to resign after 27 years in power. A hot air balloon carrying two foreign tourists has landed in the middle of a prison in India, sparking a security alert. Authorities at the Ajmer jail in Rajasthan feared the hot air balloon had come to rescue inmates inside the jail. But by the time the balloon landed, the inmates were already in their barracks. The two sisters in their early 20s, who are from the West Indies, had boarded the balloon at the annual animal fair in Pushkar, a temple town in Rajasthan. That's the latest news on Monocle 24.
Vanuit London. Dit is Monocle 24.
London으로부터 Monocle 24입니다.
De Londres. Essa é a Monocle 24.
Oi, London. This is Monocle 24.
Ot London, tu é Monocle 24.
Fra London, dette er Monocle 24.
From London, this is Londres.
Hollanda.
London, London으로부터
Hong Kong.
Hong Kong.
Zurich.
London.
This is Monocle 24.
1806 here in London. Right, the regular listeners of Midori House will know that we always start the first half hour of the programme with a roundup of the day's news. Today we have a Middle Eastern theme. We'll start with Jerusalem in just a few moments, but the two people joining me to unpick the news are Shashank Joshi, Senior Research Fellow at the Royal United Services Institute here in London, and Daniela Peled, Editor at the Institute for War and Peace Reporting, both Monocle 24 regulars, both very welcome now to Studio One. Let us begin, as I said a moment ago, with Jerusalem. One person has died and dozens are injured after a Palestinian man drove a vehicle into a group of pedestrians. CCTV footage shows a white van driven by Al-Brahim Al-Akari, a member of Hamas, according to his own website, careering into a group of people. It followed fresh violence at the Al-Aqsa or Temple Mount Monument, one of the most sacred places in Jerusalem, banned to Jews, but one of the key places of worship for the city's Muslims. The political fallout has been as bad as one would expect. Daniela, let's start with you. Last week we had you in on Monocle 24 talking about the issues with Al-Aqsa Temple Mount, this sacred place that has suddenly become the focal point of fresh violence in Jerusalem. Now, this attack by Al-Brahim Al-Akari, this is the second of its kind in 2 weeks, isn't it?
Well, that's right. And these things do tend to come in patterns. You know, there are copycat attacks, just like there are copycat, you know, suicide or any other kind of attack. A few years ago, there was a series of attacks with people driving bulldozers in Jerusalem. So I think this was to be expected. But certainly the situation on the Temple Mount continues to escalate. Jordan recalled their ambassador today in response to Israeli actions. One of those very symbolic and kind of meaningless diplomatic gestures that, you know, that are made from time to time. But more importantly, in Gaza as well, there's been trouble responding to the attacks on Al-Aqsa as they see it, because this is a very uniting cause, not just amongst different Palestinian factions, but also it's very symbolic for Muslims around the world.
So in that context, given the fact that this is a uniting cause, I mean, to what degree, Shashank, are we careering towards a fresh chapter in hostilities between the Palestinians and the Israelis, given the fact that this actually now becomes a question of faith, not just of territory?
Yes, and I think the Jordanian gesture is symbolic, as Daniela said. But of course, remember, Jordan is one of the few friends Israel has in the region. And not only that, Jordan has a special role in the Old City, in the Al-Aqsa Mosque. It's technically the custodian of the site, according to the peace treaty between Israel and Jordan, which, by the way, just turned 20. No one's celebrating it in Jordan, certainly. But the two countries need each other. They need each other for cooperation in Syria. There's instability everywhere else. So actually, this does have repercussions. I think the big risk here is, there's two types of risks. One of them is events in the West Bank and in Jerusalem become connected to events in Gaza, as Daniela said. We saw how kidnappings and revenge killings spiraled out of control only a few months ago. The other risk, and I think the one that will be really having Israeli internal security agencies frightened, is a third intifada, an uprising. And of course, these incidents do occur in patterns. We've seen these before over the decades. But we don't know whether this is something that will pass or whether it will eventually flare up into something much bigger. And the last thing I'll mention, of course, is that this is in the context of new settlement building in East Jerusalem, which is a very, very provocative issue.
We'll deal with that in just a few moments' time. Daniela, a moment ago you said that the withdrawal of the Jordanian ambassador was symbolic, but at the same time quite meaningless. Shashank there has just stressed the importance of the mediating role of Jordan?
Well, I think because Jordan's special role, as Shashank just said, it has to make these gestures, because the idea of Israel's peace with Jordan is pretty controversial in Jordan. I mean, it's seen as half the population are Palestinian, and it's seen as perhaps necessary, but rather it's not something that people are very happy about or proud about, although it's all about the status quo. And that's what Jerusalem comes down to as well. What the Israeli government have said continuously is we have no plans to change the status quo on the Temple Mount and the holy sites of Jerusalem. The problem is that a right-wing coalition government, being a right-wing coalition government, also has friends whose agenda might be very fringe in terms of allowing Jewish prayer on the Temple Mount or even rebuilding the Third Temple, which is quite apocalyptic. But the Israeli government courts these people as well as part of their political strategy. So although it's a very, very fringe movement as far as Israeli politics are concerned, the idea that people want to harm or want to intrude on the holy sites in Jerusalem is one that gains an immense amount of traction.
Daniel, wasn't it Ariel Sharon's visit to the Temple Mount that sparked off a great deal of trouble?
It sparked a great deal. It was said to start the first Intifada. I'm not sure that Intifadas start quite so simply and spontaneously
as
that.
It's a trigger, though.
Well, he made a political point, an internal political point, and it was extremely unhelpful, if I can use a diplomatic language. The sad thing is, as I said, is that the majority of Israelis are secular. The majority of religious Israelis really don't care that much about the Temple Mount, and they would not go and pray there because for religious purposes, the rabbinate of Israel advises quite strictly against it.
Because it is apparently banned in the Torah as well to go.
Well, because the Holy, if you want to get into it, the Holy of Holies.
Seeing as we're here.
The Holy of Holies was in the original temple, and you never know when you might walk across it.
Midori House is being replaced with a theology seminar now on.
We need to know why they're fighting. I mean, one of the reasons that all this has kicked off in the last couple of weeks was the shooting of Yehuda Glick, an Israeli-American rabbi who is still seriously ill. But he was the far right section of it. I mean, Daniela, a moment ago...
Oh, it gets more right than him,
this is a section that you just mentioned a moment ago, Daniela, that Netanyahu is not pushing away. In fact, in certain areas, he's courting it. To what degree, Shashank, is this an internal political problem that Netanyahu might be able to unpick himself and calm things down a bit?
I think that the domestic politics is driving a great deal of it. As I said, there are other factors, including tension around settlement building, tension that persists from the hostilities and the cycle of attacks that occurred over the preceding six to eight months or so. But you, of course, have a prime minister who faces a coalition whose centre of gravity is evidently moving to the right, where the electorate is breathing down his neck. And I think he is constrained in how far he can stop all of this. He, of course, has to allow a little bit of slack for political reasons.
So you have the electioneering on one side, Daniela. The UN in the last few hours has accused the Palestinians of not having strong enough leadership to actually sort themselves out. I mean, there is too much strength on the Israeli side and too much weakness not strong enough. Would you agree?
I'm not sure. There are many within Israel as well that would criticise Netanyahu for not being strong enough, both from the right and actually from what remains the diminishing left. One of the problems of this issue is that the whole issue of Jerusalem is based on this fiction from the Israeli point of view of it being a unified, eternal capital of Israel and the Jewish people. Anyone who's been to Jerusalem, been to East Jerusalem, sees that this is not the case. It is a fiction. There are East Jerusalemites, Palestinians, without Israeli passports. Now, Israeli society likes to think that they're kind of Palestinian extra. So they're not really part of the conflict because they benefit from the services to a greater extent that Israel offers than Palestinians in the West Bank. But Israel is Jerusalem is a place where Israelis and Palestinians are brought into contact now in a way that you don't see anywhere else. Israelis and don't have any contact, very, very little contact with Palestinians in the West Bank, let alone Gaza. Jerusalem is a place where people are living side by side, but not in coexistence.
Well, in fact, we talk about settlements, and I said settlements at the beginning. But of course, if you go look at the settlements, they are, you know, almost urban areas that have great physical separation from surrounding Palestinian territory. Whereas in Arab East Jerusalem, one of the triggers for the recent tension, of course, has been Jewish people buying housing unit inside Arab areas, not as settlers in the West Bank, as they would consider it, but more through Palestinian intermediaries. This is not sort of our conventional image of a settler. This is about land purchases in Arab neighborhoods and the tension that that creates. But that's a function of proximity.
There's, I read somewhere, I think, that some houses on the foothills of Temple Mount are now being developed on, and you know, property investors are coming in and trying to sort of push that area. I mean, Daniela, to what degree do you have, when you have so many people in close proximity, what do you see the long-term effects of this being? I mean, from the outside, it doesn't seem like a very good prospect, does it?
Well, that's with usual British understatement. No, I would say the long-term prospects are more of the same, because what Israel has been maintaining in Jerusalem, in the West Bank, as far as the occupation goes in general, is the status quo. The status quo, as far as Israel is concerned, is the best that they can achieve. They look around at the region, they look at the Palestinians and say, we don't have a partner for peace. Abu Mazen might talk moderation, but really he doesn't represent all the Palestinians. Hamas aren't interested. Across our borders, we've got ISIS, we've got chaos, we've got all these things. The status quo, i.e. keeping our relative short-term security at all costs, that is the Israeli strategic vision.
But I would just amend that, because when you say status quo, people may misunderstand that to mean a fixed state of affairs, a fixed set of facts on the ground. Of course, the status quo is itself, it itself entails expanding control, expanding settlements, expanding housing units, expanding building, and to the point where if we have the discussion about a future Palestinian state, the role that Jerusalem may play within it and how it may be split, that conversation will look fundamentally different to how it did at the time of the Oslo Accords 20 years ago in a very, very negative way. And in 20 further years, I think it will look even more abysmal.
I'm joined by Shashank Joshi, Senior Research Fellow at the Royal United Service Institute, and Daniela Pellard, Editor at the Institute of War and Peace Reporting. Let us turn now to Egypt and to Sinai, or more exactly across the Egyptian border with the Gaza Strip. There are reports in the last 24 hours of more than 1,000 families being evicted from their homes in an attempt by Cairo to rid the region of Islamic militants. The group is called Ansar Bayt al-Maqdis, believed to be an Islamic State-inspired offshoot of Al-Qaeda, and it's thought to have been responsible for the deaths of 33 Egyptian security personnel last week. We'll address the consequences for those people who are being moved in just a moment. But first, Shashank, explain to me who is or are Ansar Bayt al-Maqdi, an ISIS-inspired Al-Qaeda-supported group. It can't get much worse, can it?
Well, I'm always a little bit wary of these people who badge themselves as ISIS-inspired. I mean, jihadists have been operating in Sinai for years and years and years, to the point where it's a very heavily militarized province. Of course, there has been a great deal of cooperation between Israel and Egypt, having talked about Israel, just as there is between Israel and Jordan. The Israelis have relished the ascendance of a military regime in Cairo because they can resume that kind of counterterrorism in the Sinai against people like these jihadists. The Islamic State is a very useful brand, and on, you know, to which they can attach themselves, much as breakaway elements of the Pakistani Taliban or Southeast Asian jihadists have also attached themselves. Does it mean there is any kind of operational control between Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi sitting in Raqqa in Syria and these people wandering around the desert in Sinai? Of course not. I think that's absolute nonsense. What I do think is the case is that the Egyptian state's level of control over this territory has gone down. And what we have seen are Ansar Bayt al-Maqdis conduct attacks of an audacity they weren't doing previously. They've taken down Egyptian military aircraft. They've been massacring Egyptian military personnel in absolutely horrific numbers. And all of this is connected to a bigger arc of conflict that goes from Libya and other parts of North Africa right into Gaza and further to the east. And that's why it's so dangerous.
You're nodding, Daniela.
I'm nodding. I do think that... I think the idea that ISIS are exporting their brand is a little bit far-fetched. You know, I quite agree with Shashank on that. But I think also the Egyptians are using this as a useful tool. I mean, the threat is very real, but I think they're using it as a very useful tool. I mean, they're accusing Hamas of, which are, of course, their bitter foes, they're accusing Hamas of involvement in all this trouble in the Sinai. Well, not only do Hamas have enough problems to deal with of their own, but they also have been trying to fight quite hard against the jihadis and Salafis in the Gaza Strip as well. It's also a useful way of the Egyptian regime to say, look, you're either with us or against us. already the Egyptian media have rallied behind them and said, right, okay, anyone who criticises the Egyptian army or government at this crucial time is profoundly un-Egyptian and we're not going to stand for it. And enormous amounts of self-censorship going on in the Egyptian media.
I thought we do have to go back to the point of theology here. Just to be very, very clear.
We've seen this line
coming out of Israel, you know, Bibi Netanyahu saying, Hamas, ISIS, same thing. We've seen the Egyptian regime saying Hamas equals Muslim Brotherhood, same thing, you know, equals ISIS in turn. So in other words, they have this commonality of interest between Netanyahu and al-Sisi.
It's possibly the politicising of a theology. You immediately seize upon it and you know, in the way that they have outlawed the Muslim Brotherhood. As Daniela said, you are with us or you are against us. And effectively, Islam seems to be the tipping point, at least in Egypt.
Well, I mean, it's factually wrong because the Brotherhood are a particular theological strand and the Salafis are a distinct opposing theological strand. The Brotherhood have traditionally been far more political, far more active in politics, including in democratic politics and parliamentary politics when they can, whereas the Salafis have been much more cautious. So the identification is just factually nonsense. But of course, it's dog whistle politics and it serves the Egyptian regime's purpose of cracking down on any Islamist opposition inside Egypt. Whether they've got a beard, you must be the baddies. Let's all murder you in vast numbers, and it's all okay. But it's absolutely ridiculous politics.
You mentioned at the beginning of this, Daniela, the effect on people. I mean, there are 1,000 families now who have been removed from this strip, effectively to try and create a no man's land, ostensibly to single out and to weaken this group of militants. But the effect on their day-to-day lives is not only catastrophic in the immediate, but there are risks. I read somewhere that they will be pushing them into the arms of the militants. How much of a realistic possibility is that?
Well, I think if the representative of state comes and uproots you with 48 hours notice and offers you, I think the equivalent was £100.
It's three months' rent.
It's some ludicrous amount. And I heard an official being quoted today who said, well, why would they mind? One bit of desert is the same as any other bit. I think you might slightly turn against that state. You might not be particularly friendly to it. This is also about economy. This is about smuggling, which has gone on across borders endlessly. The Egyptian state has managed to destroy most of the large tunnels, which have smuggled, you know, quantities of concrete and cars and livestock into Gaza. But there are small tunnels which carry on making a small and modest living for the people that run them. People feel, I'm sure, that they're being personally targeted.
Shashank, very briefly, before we must go to a break in a moment, what does this mean for Egypt internationally? Because at the moment it was seen as being the great sponsor of the Palestinian-Israeli talks in the last few months. It has an international role to play, no matter how well or badly it plays it. What does this do for them?
It allows them to continue sucking vast amounts of military aid and money from Washington. They do face a real military threat. I don't mean to pretend it's imaginary, but what it does is give them a shield behind which to pursue their utterly self-destructive political agenda of quashing all domestic opposition.
We're going to take a short break now on that note. You're listening to Midori House here with Emma Nelson, joined by Shashank Joshi and Daniela Pellad. We return in just a moment, continuing our look at the Middle East. We talk Lebanon and football.
The new issue of Monocle is all about building a better life, literally. That's because it contains our autumn design survey, aimed at creating the home you want. But there's a lot more to get your teeth into.
In the design section, we head to Toronto to reveal the new Aga Khan Museum.
In the edit section, we head to Manhattan for a gin martini and a spot of supper with a dapper journalist, Gay Talesi, for his last meal.
The November issue of Monocle is on newsstands now. Go out and buy yourself a copy, or better still, become a subscriber. Visit monocle.com to find out how. Monocle, keeping an eye on the world.
Welcome back to Midori House here on Monocle 24. Now, Lebanon has quite terrifyingly been described recently as one of the more stable countries in a region of sheer chaos, which makes one realise just how bad things are elsewhere. Well, the country's parliament has just voted to extend its mandate until 2017 amid security fears. Shashank Joshi, this is the second time in what, 2 years? This does not bode well, does it?
This concept is hilarious, isn't it? That it's an elected parliament. Shall we all collectively decide we should not be sacked for another few years? yes, motion passed, you know, let's just go on for a while. It's obviously a sign, first of all, of domestic problems and domestic deadlock. But I think it's worth bearing in mind this is also part of a regional struggle. What you are seeing is standoff over many issues, including electoral laws, including the status of the next president. But for example, the presidential candidate and who should be the next president, the different blocs disagree. You've got broadly a Hezbollah-backed bloc that says one person, and you've got a pro-Saudi bloc, the March 14th Alliance of various actors within Lebanon who are, you know, to put it very crudely, I don't want to overly sectarianize it, but the Sunni bloc, you could say, backed by Saudi Arabia, who wants another candidate. So in other words, this is also about the bigger regional struggle that has not gone away in many years.
Daniela, the Prime Minister Tamam Salam said the extension until 2017 is aimed at stopping the country from plunging into a power vacuum. What is this power vacuum?
Well, power vacuum or chaos, really, which is the other side of the coin. I mean, it does sound very awful sitting here in London knowing that the Parliament has done this profoundly anti-democratic thing. But I was talking to a colleague in Beirut earlier today, and she said, frankly, it's awful, but the alternative is worse, really. And I think if you look at the protest against it, 2 years ago, the protests were much larger. A couple of dozen people turned up in Beirut to throw tomatoes and eggs today and say this is wrong. I mean, the coalition has shrunk immensely. I think what we see in Lebanon, as we see in many other places in the region, people want stability at all counts. That my colleague said to me, my grandparents lived through a civil war. My parents lived through a civil war. I lived through a war with Israel. I don't want another war.
Simple as that.
Lebanon's already, and you're right, what they don't want is more war or escalating war, because it already is at war, of course. You know, the Lebanese army is currently engaged in operations against militants in various parts of the country. There is already spillover from Syria, however much they try and pursue a policy of disassociation, as they call it. And one of the simple facts is, one of the reasons they couldn't hold an election is they didn't have the security for it. And the agencies who are responsible for providing security for elections are, of course, now all controlled by Hezbollah, which has its own interest in maintaining the status quo.
Let's hear from a Lebanese MP who explained why they have extended their mandate. This is Walid Jumblat.
It means we had no choice. Because of some political, let's say, quarrels or disputes, we could not elect the president. But we cannot leave the country without a parliament. Because if we leave the country without a parliament, the deadline is on the 20th, will be total chaos. This is why we have prolonged the mandate of the parliament.
Spoken in those terms, Daniela, it sounds like complete common sense. Extend your parliament, that means that you can keep a little bit of stability while you're trying to work out who your president is going to be.
Well, do any of us really think the regional situation is going to be substantially different in 2017? I really hope so. For the last 3 years, especially with the Syrian civil war, the situation has seemed unsustainable, that we're going to have a breakthrough, there's going to be some calm, some element of stability in the region, but that hasn't happened yet. I'm not quite sure where the map is going to be in 2017.
It does made me, when I read this story, I just thought, actually, does it really matter that much, given the fact that every time we look at Lebanon, you always dismiss the government as being utterly hopeless to start off with? They seem to be not in control of the country anyway.
That's right. I think that's right. But at the same time, the status quo is preferable to an outright situation of chaos. And to give you one example, the Lebanese army, okay, it's not the most powerful armed force in the country, that would be Hezbollah, but it is still a force in the country. It's a counterweight to Hezbollah to some small extent. And this is why countries like Saudi Arabia and the United States, not exactly known to support Hezbollah, pump money into the Lebanese army. They see some value in it surviving as an institution. Now, if you have the complete collapse of the state, and the army would fall apart. It would fall apart along sectarian lines. Hezbollah would expand its control. That's clearly, you know, less than desirable. And so don't give up on the Lebanese state yet, is what I'm getting at. It may be, you know, not have control, but it's still there.
We must move on. Finally, briefly, you spoke a moment ago, Shashank, of an outright situation of chaos. Well, how's this? We turn, unusually for Monocle 24, to football. We're staying in the Middle East as well. There are ugly scenes at the Tel Aviv derby between rival teams, forgive me my pronunciation, Hapoel and Maccabi.
Derby. A fan ran onto the pitch during the derby in the 33rd minute, started to have a go at one of the players, and it went downhill after that. By all accounts, there was a fight, a proper one, between this fan and the star player of Maccabi, Eran Zahavi. Mr. Zahavi was banned, was given the red card, and it took 10 minutes for the game to start again. Daniela, why do we care that this derby is turned into such a mess?
Well, I think if you look at the wider picture, you could say that it reflects a kind of state of lawlessness in Israel, really.
Because, or in football.
Well, in football, the point is if you have the rule of law enforced equally and properly, then perhaps there's a bit of a deterrent for this to happen.
You'd have made a killer sports mistress at school.
Yeah,
you would
yes.
have been a nightmare.
I would have been very strict.
Enforcing the rule of law. Shashank, to what degree does Daniela have a very good point that this is a reflection of a wider chaos?
Having talked about Lebanon, it just seems wrong to try and read too much into the wider state of Israeli politics. I think the fact is, in not just in Israel, not just in the Middle East, in many, many parts of the world, you see this in Southern Europe a lot as well. Football is a very political enterprise. I mean, it historically has been in the UK as well, in parts of Scotland. Look at the Celtic Rangers derby and the way that maps onto various sectarian and therefore political differences. You know, these are occasions where you have vast amounts of testosterone-fueled men who've probably been drinking in vast numbers who get very angry at slight provocations. I mean, I get angry at the television watching Manchester derbies, so I can imagine what it must be like in a Tel Aviv derby.
Have you ever been tempted, though, to run onto a pitch and attack one of your players?
I mean, listeners haven't got the benefit of seeing me, but I feel, you know, you might be able to appreciate why I wouldn't survive very long having sprinted onto the pitch, whereas I'm sure the gentleman who ran on to the Tel Aviv pitch could probably look after himself slightly better than I could.
I'm sure there is an inner ferocity, Shashank, that one day we will no doubt see. On that note, thank you very much to you both, Daniela Pellet and Shashank Joshi, joining us for a half-hour special on the Middle East.
London, New York, Tokyo. This is Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. Това е Monocle 24.
Лондрис, Нова Йорк, Токио.
London, New York, Tokyo. Dette er Monocle 24.
Londonist, New Yorkist, Tokiost. Se on Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo, Monocle 24 desu.
Londino, New York, Tokyo.
This is Monocle 24.
Plenty still to come in the second half hour of today's Midori House. We'll check in with our correspondent in Brussels to find out how a transport strike is about to make bad congestion in the city a lot worse. Before that, we'll get the latest world news headlines here from Bill.
Republicans have taken control of the US Senate away from Democrats in midterm elections. Their success limits President Barack Obama's lawmaking agenda during his last 2 years in office. The decisive win shifts the balance of power between the White House and Capitol Hill only 6 years after Mr. Obama's Democrats swept to power. An Israeli border police officer has been killed in eastern Jerusalem when the driver of a commercial van ran him over. Israeli police say 13 pedestrians were also injured by the vehicle before the driver got out and attacked several people with a metal bar. Police shot and killed the attacker, who was identified as a member of the Islamist Hamas movement. At least 11 children are thought to have been killed in Damascus when mortars fell on a school in an eastern district of the Syrian capital. The British-based Syrian Observatory for Human Rights says the death toll is expected to rise. The presidents of Nigeria, Ghana and Senegal have arrived in Burkina Faso to push the army to speed up the transition of power to civilian leaders. The African Union accused the military of acting unconstitutionally when it took over from President Blaise Compaoré last week. He was forced to resign after 27 years in power. Those are the latest headlines on Monocle 24.
Rolex is responsible for several landmark innovations in watchmaking, including the Oyster, the first waterproof wristwatch, and the perpetual rotor self-winding mechanism. Crafted from the finest raw materials and assembled with scrupulous attention to detail, Oyster perpetual watches benefit from Rolex's cutting-edge technology and extensive expertise. Epitomizing the values that have made the brand world famous, Oyster perpetual watches symbolize a way of life, a benchmark for style.
And And you're back with Midori House. The time here in London is 18:34, which means if you're listening in the middle of the night in Shanghai, it's 2:34 a.m. Same time as it is in Beijing. In Jerusalem, it's 20:34. Let's check in with one of our correspondents across the world. We can hear from Charlotte McDonald Gibson now on the line from Brussels. A very warm welcome to the programme, Charlotte. A few bits that you wanted to talk about tonight, including Jean-Claude Juncker, the new European Commission chief, standing up today, first day in the job, picks a fight.
He has indeed. He started picking a fight yesterday, in fact, and he has particular targets in mind. One of them is not hugely surprising. It's David Cameron. The British Prime Minister hasn't exactly got the cosiest relationship with the EU, and it seems that's being more reciprocated these days. And secondly, Matteo Renzi as well, the Italian Prime Minister. He's been singled out for a bit of banter. And this is a result of the European Council, the summit of EU leaders last month, when both Mr. Cameron and Mr. Renzi had a few choice words about the European Commission after the Commission turned around and asked them for rather hefty payments towards the EU budget, which they weren't expecting. So, interesting sort of first swipes we've seen today from the leaders.
Why do you think he's taken such a pugilistic approach? Because his predecessor, José Manuel Barroso, was firing a few shots before he went through the door as well.
It's interesting because Mr. Juncker, in the run-up to taking over this position, he was really sending out some very conciliatory messages to the UK, saying how important it was for Britain to remain part of the EU. So maybe just now that he's taken power, he's in that job, he doesn't have to woo any more leaders anymore, he's got the job, he's sort of setting out his negotiating position, perhaps. He's saying, I'm not going to, take a soft stance. I'm going to tell it like it is, and we'll take it from there. It's going to be a couple of hard years of negotiation as David Cameron tries to renegotiate Britain's membership with the EU. So maybe it's strategic.
Let's hope so. Now, let's turn to the constant fight to try to find either a cure or something to stop the spread of Ebola. Antwerp is proving to be the centre of this.
Yes, that's right. There are obviously historical links between Belgium and Africa. They had a colony in the Congo. The Congo was one of their colonial possessions for a long time. And because of this, the Institute of Tropical Medicine in Antwerp is now one of the leading research institutes into Ebola. It was, in fact, the place where they first discovered Ebola back in 1976. They received a flask of blood from a Belgian nun who had got sick in what was then Zaire and is now Democratic Republic of Congo. And that led to the discovery of this new virus and a three-month research program at the time deep into the rainforest of the Congo. And now the Institute is really at the back of the forefront again of the research. And today, a couple of their scientists went out to Guinea to start what is going to be the first comprehensive study into whether blood from Ebola survivors can be used to treat new patients. It's been used experimentally a few times, but there's been no comprehensive study until now, and they're really hoping to get that underway and have some results that can actually have an impact on this current epidemic.
Finally, Charlotte, let's talk about transport in Brussels. Quite a problem as it is on the best of days, but by all accounts on Thursday, people are being told to stay away.
It's going to be a bit of a nightmare tomorrow, I think. So there's a big demonstration against austerity measures, which is starting in the centre of Brussels and going through some of the main thoroughfares during the day tomorrow. And police have urged people to keep their cars at home because there's going to be no parking. The major arteries are going to be congested. At the same time, however, the public transport workers are having a walkout over the same reasons, this new austerity package. So if you can't take your car out and you can't use public transport, it's a bit mystifying how anybody's going to get anywhere at all tomorrow.
As a result of that, what warnings are people being given and done? Because you do have a few infrastructure issues to iron out, don't you? Whether people will or will not be able to be productive on a working day.
Yes, exactly. The advice we've had is really to not use cars. So that doesn't really give us many alternatives if the public transport doesn't work. But yes, bicycles, for example, that's one option. But it's raining right now here. I'm not particularly fond of the idea of getting on a bike tomorrow on Brussels' rather narrow cobbled roads. I mean, that's one of the problems why traffic is usually so bad, is there isn't a great cycling network. The roads haven't really been adapted to bicycles. So alternatives are few and far between, I think.
Monocle Charlotte McDonald-Gibson in Brussels. Thank you very much indeed. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24. Up next, we celebrate 40 years of Blondie.
The Entrepreneurs is Monocle's weekly audio guide to the world's best business minds. From industry giants and family outfits to the one-man bands and clever upstarts.
We saw all this immense amount of frustration by young people finding their first jobs, their second jobs, internships. And we said it's ridiculous that in this day and age, with all the technology we have, we can't solve that.
Tune in at 1900 hours London time every Wednesday to hear insider tips, big challenges, and sparks of insight. We take an hour-long tour of the worlds of fashion to food, timepieces to tech, and hear the founding stories of some of the smartest names around.
I remember saying, deliver beer in New York City. I can hardly afford my car insurance, so I'm going to insure a truck.
That's The Entrepreneurs, premiering every Wednesday at 1900 hours London time, in association with Pictet.
'21:40 in Moscow to 1840 here in London. Welcome back to Midori House. This is Emma Nelson. Now, there aren't many people who were there at the beginning of the punk rock movement and are still here. Even fewer had a camera, but luckily Chris Stein is a co-founder of Blondie and he had his. To celebrate the 40th anniversary of the band, an exhibition is touring of unpublished photographs of scenes from when they were on tour, when they were on stage. Well, today, the exhibit Chris Stein, Negative, Me, Blondie and the Advent of Punk opens at Somerset House here in London. And we sent Monocle's Gaia Lutz to the opening where she caught up with the curator, Stephen Doherty.
As you know, Blondie's 40th anniversary is this year and this is an exhibition of intimate portraits, almost fly-on-the-wall documentary captured in portraiture of Debbie Harry and the band from a time before they were famous, when they were just forming the band Blondie, and it charts their career through the decades until the sort of late 90s, really. And it's an extraordinarily intimate portrait of their life, captured by Chris Stein, Debbie Harry's partner, who knows her better than anybody else. And so what you get in this exhibition is a series of images that nobody else would have had access to photograph and actually couldn't have done so because he just knows her better than anybody else. Most of these images have not been seen outside of this exhibition or outside the book that accompanies the exhibition, but there are one or two fairly sort of iconic images that people will recognise, but mostly largely unseen photographs.
And are these mostly of her time in America or of tours as well, or does it encompass everything?
It encompasses everything. We basically set out the exhibition in a roughly chronological fashion that follows the layout of the book. It starts off early days in New York. There are some shots of them on tour, but largely New York and America. Here we are in the first room of the exhibition, and this really charts the time before they became famous. And there's one image that I particularly like. I think it has a slightly desolate feel, but if you read the information about the photograph we're looking at, it's of a gas station in New York on a winter's day. It has a kind of bleak feel, but it sort of sets the scene for what New York was like in the 1970s. And you were asking earlier on about, did the environment, did the sort of culture of the times have an influence on the way they developed as a band and the whole sort of emergence of new wave? And I think obviously it did. It was a dark time and they were ready for change and colour and life and vibrancy, and I think this is a great way to start the exhibition, and it gives a sense of what it was like. And sometimes out of sort of bleakness and direness there comes this massive surge of creativity, which I think is where we're headed. As we walk around the exhibition you'll see it develop. Band at the end of the first room, And what I particularly like about this one is the fact that, I mean, they're barely recognisable. They've all got long hair. And I think they were influenced at the time by Mott the Hoople. And so they've got this sort of all the young dudes hairstyles here. And of course, that was later to change with the very sort of sharp cuts that were almost sort of Beatlesque in a way. So, but it's a great image. And just as they were starting out and maybe had no idea where they were going, who knows, that's what I'd like to think.
So when was that picture taken?
This is also sort of early to mid 70s, but it's a picture of Debbie Harry in a little t-shirt and two dolls lying at her feet. And there's obviously a play there with that whole sort of pun around the New York dolls at the time. But actually it was it's a shot that's now been recognised as one of the great sort of iconographic rock and roll images of all time. It was voted by Q magazine as one of the best there is. And I mean, I think it says it all really, doesn't it?
It's so punk.
Yeah. And of course, you know, Debbie is really photogenic, and you can't really take a bad photograph. She looks great in everything. Thing I should say is that you might notice if you look up at the ceiling of these quite ornate galleries, we flooded the space with coloured lights. We've got pink, acidy sort of day glow pink and yellow in some of the rooms, and we wanted to create a sense of mood and vibrancy from the sort of 70s and the emergence of the new wave scene. I mean, it's something I remember very strongly, those sort of bright acid pinks and yellows. And so we thought, just to give it a slightly different edge from a very formal photographic exhibition, to flood the rooms with colour, which gets more intense as the light outside drops, was a nice little play.
And at this time, obviously Blondie was still at its beginning and its roots, but did she or the band have a notion that they were new wave, do you think? Or is this something that came later when they met other artists and they started to get involved with the movement?
Well, I think if you look around, you'll see pictures of loads of other bands who might be considered punk and new wave. And they were part of a movement. They were pioneers of this new wave. So it was a whole creative force. And in this room, you'll see that we've got mostly images of Debbie where she just looks wonderful and glamorous. So this is our little sort of homage to Debbie looking moody and beautiful.
In her room, if you could pick out one of these pictures.
Here's probably a really well-known one. This is Debbie wearing a dress that's rumoured to be a dress worn by Marilyn Monroe in The Seven Year Itch. And it's in their flat that Chris and Debbie shared together, which actually got burnt down. And then they went back afterwards to see what they could salvage, and they're cooking a meal in a burnt down flat. Apparently Debbie had cats at the time. They actually survived the blaze, which is incredible, by hiding in a cupboard. So it's a happy end to the story. But it's an amazing shot, and to think that somebody would be burning something in a frying pan in a Marilyn Monroe dress is quite funny.
Stephen Doherty there, talking to Monocle's Gaia Lutz. The exhibit Chris Stein, Negative Me, Blondie and the Advent of Punk runs from today, the 5th of November, until January the 25th at Somerset House here in London. You're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24. The time is 18:48 here in London. I don't think we've heard enough, Blondie. Here's a bit more, and they're best, arguably, one way or another. Blondie there, and one way or another. The time here in London is 18:50. You're with Midori House. You're back with Midori House here on Monocle 24. Time now for our daily arts review. Today we talk theatre with Matt Wolfe, a theatre critic for the International Herald Tribune. Lately in this parish, normally in this parish, Mr. Wolfe, but you find yourself in our New York bureau. What takes you there?
Yeah, how did I get here, I wonder? Well, what took me here was Virgin Atlantic, but what is actually keeping me here for 10 days is a really extraordinary array of star-driven theater. I mean, there have always been stars on Broadway. Broadway loves stars. But this season, even more than ever, coming up still to open, we have Bradley Cooper, Hugh Jackman, Glenn Close, John Lithgow, and many others. So it's very celeb-y.
We have talked about this before extensively. In fact, what appears to be many years, that you get these big names, big tickets, they sell out in seconds, then everybody else is scrabbling to get a ticket, which then costs hundreds of dollars. And you kind of feel as if there's a disconnect between what's happening in the world of theatre and what's happening in the world of showbizy theatre. Is that very much the case where you are at the moment?
I think so, but I think also part of it is that a lot of these movie actors are realizing that the stuff they're doing on screen may not be all that, dare one use the word, nourishing. And there is something about going back to the theatrical well. I mean, Bradley Cooper began in the theater. Hugh Jackman began in the theater. So it's like going home for them. The other thing is that a lot of these actors who do theater do well. You know, Scarlett Johansson came to do a play a few years ago. She won a Tony. The same thing with Catherine Zeta-Jones. So I think the risk factor is less extreme than it used to be.
What about the risk factor for everybody else who doesn't have to be? Happen to be Bradley Cooper or Catherine Zeta-Jones? That kind of pushes everyone out, doesn't it?
Well, the thing is, then you have these kind of long-running musicals where nobody knows who's in them. I mean, no one has any idea who's in Phantom of the Opera or in Mamma Mia in London or Broadway. So that's a different kind of theatrical ecosystem. These are, as you say, usually plays, not musicals, on for 16, 18, 20 weeks. The ticket prices are often stratospheric. The producers make their money, and then the show ends, and that's it, on to the next. And that's the case with much of what we'll be talking about.
I wonder what we're going to be thinking about in the next 15, 20 years when no great new plays are broken on Broadway or no great new actors are broken on Broadway simply because of, as you say, the musicals where everybody's dressed up in, I don't know, a mask or a Lion King hat. Or they are Catherine Zeta-Jones. Is there a long-term worry here, Matt?
No, I don't really think so, because, of course, a lot of these people did do theater before we knew who they were. So in a way, the fun thing is going to some off-Broadway shows and thinking, oh, which one of these guys or girls is going to be the next Romola Gary, who's in a play now, or Holly Hunter, who's in a play now. In other words, they are doing theater, but we may not clock them until they become famous.
Okay, let's have a look, or let's talk about at least some of these plays. You want to start with This Is Our Youth, something that has been in London, now transferring to Broadway, or is it being redone? Tell us a little bit more about it.
Yeah, I mean, this is a really wonderful play by Kenny Lonergan, the guy who wrote You Can Count on Me, the Laura Linney film from a while ago, which is on a lot of people's favorite films lists. This is a play that was done in London with a rotating cast of young Hollywood stars a while ago, preeminently Jake Gyllenhaal, but it's an American play about privileged, disaffected youth on the Upper West Side of Manhattan, a really painful, bleakly written play. And what's interesting here is the casting. You have two actors who've never been on Broadway, Kieran Culkin, younger brother of Macaulay, and Michael Cera, who's, I guess, better known for movies like Juno. And there's always a lot of cynicism about, you know, actors coming to the theater. In this instance, oh, they're just trying to prove their street cred or whatever. But in this case, both these guys can actually do it. They seem like natural, bona fide stage animals, and that's really, really satisfying. This is the third or fourth production of the play I've seen, and far and away the best.
I mean, this sounds as if this is a play that obviously is a misery to watch, but one of those delightful miseries, I'm hoping. To what degree do you think this is a decent revival?
Oh, it's a superb revival, directed by Anna De Shapiro, who's a director. She did August Osage County, which, of course, was made into a film, but she did the stage version of it that came to London and was a big deal everywhere. And she's a proper director. This isn't just a kind of vanity celebrity production. It's a proper production that began in Chicago from the ground up with these same actors and has come to Broadway. So it's not just a slapdash, let's put some name actors in and see if we can hoodwink the money out of ticket buyers. It's an organically arrived at piece. It is painful, but it's also very funny, it's quite bruising. The irony of it is that the ticket prices in New York are so expensive that I don't know whether the youth who might go see a play called This Is Our Youth can afford it, but I guess they can always ask their parents.
Let's move on to Tom Stoppard, play with Maggie Gyllenhaal, The Real Thing. A muted review of this one. Not everyone going bananas for it, despite the huge names in it.
Yeah, I mean, interesting. Also, two actors making Broadway debuts, Maggie Gyllenhaal, whose brother Jake is coming to Broadway next month in a different play, and Ewan McGregor, who's never been on Broadway before either. This is the third time The Real Thing's been done in New York. I've seen all three productions. This is the least good. It just doesn't feel, the world of Stopper doesn't feel like a natural fit for either star. Ewan McGregor seems a little bit stolid and reined in. His natural, wonderful Scottish accent here, very clipped in English, and it sounds like he's not comfortable with what's coming out of his mouth. Maggie Hall, not quite the sensualist that the role demands, a part played brilliantly by Jennifer Ely in the last Broadway production. So you feel slightly as if they're at odds with the play.
Which is strange, given the fact that obviously they would have chosen that cast or that play very, very particularly to try and get it to work. Briefly and finally, Sticks and Bones, another big name, Holly Hunter.
Yeah, this is extraordinary, although, oh my God, it's painful watching. It's a revival of a play from 1972 about the legacy of the Vietnam War. The young actor Ben Schnetzer, who's on the film Pride, he actually has the lead role in Pride, making an astonishing New York stage appearance as a guy returning from Vietnam who's blind. Holly Hunter and Bill Pullman play his parents, who are ill-equipped in every way to deal with the son who has newly arrived in their midst. And it's really brutal, really painful. It takes no prisoners. And if you do see it, just be prepared for an ending that is pretty grim.
Brilliant. I shall look forward to it with immense excitement. Matt Wolf, thank you very much. Oh, very briefly, Matt, if you had to, if you had just one evening in infinite resources and could get a ticket anywhere, would you go for This Is Our Youth, The Real Thing, or Sticks and Bones?
If you've got a strong stomach, without a doubt, Sticks and Bones.
Brilliant. I don't imagine what happens there. Matt Wolf in New York, thank you very much indeed for joining us on the programme.
Thank you.
And that's all the time we have for today's Midori House. My thanks in particular to our special guests, Shashank Joshi and Daniela Pellad. Today's show was produced by Emily Elias. My thanks to her. It was researched by David Pleasant, and thanks too to our studio manager, Chad Chilvers. Next up, after the headlines, is The Entrepreneurs. Daniel Giacopelli is your host for that. Then at 2200 hours, join us for the Monocle Daily. Andrew Muller and I will be talking, among other things, about Burkina Faso. And at this show, the Midori House will be back at the same time tomorrow. That's 1800 hours London time. But for this edition of Midori House, from me, Emma Nelson, it's goodbye. Thank you very much for listening.
Rolex is responsible for several landmark innovations in watchmaking, including the Oyster, the first waterproof wristwatch, and the perpetual rotor self-winding mechanism. Crafted from the finest raw materials and assembled with scrupulous attention to detail, Oyster perpetual watches benefit from Rolex's cutting-edge technology and extensive expertise. Epitomizing the values that have made the brand world famous, Oyster perpetual watches symbolize a way of life, a benchmark for style.